Shango, moju ba.
That people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use
yeah.
to find themselves on the map of human geography.
Okay.
History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Sometimes we're not prepared for adversity. When it happens, sometimes we're caught short. We don't know exactly how to handle it when it comes up. Sometimes we don't know just what to do when adversity takes over. And I have advice for all of us. I got it from our pianist, Joe Zavidu, who wrote this tune. And it sounds like what you're supposed to say when you have that kind of problem. It's called mercy. 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 Mercy, mercy, mercy. Thank you.
Hotep and greetings, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers, and we are here for another wonderful afternoon program on the Black Reality Think Tank. As you know, we are here every Tuesday. We're here every Tuesday from 8 p.m. To 10 p.m. on timeforawakening.com. And we have a very exciting discussion that we'd like to present this afternoon, and hopefully that we can provide you with information or empower your thoughts, as many of you are working toward building agendas and fighting for the cause of African American liberation. So it's really an honor to be here. Our topic tonight is the Black press in America. We have pleaded our own cause for too long. Others have pleaded our cause. And we need to now plead our own cause with the calling of the origin of the Black press in America. So I thought this was a very appropriate topic for a lot of reasons, because the subject matter embraces and touches on so many areas of our history and our culture. It is a wonderful, the Black press is a wonderful resource to research and to use as a tool and a vehicle for trying to understand a lot of what our ancestors were fighting for and what is it that they were pushing forward for us now in the 21st century. A dynamic tool to use for examining African-American history and African-American life. And so we're going to talk a lot about the Black press tonight, and we would definitely always love your participation. We'd like for you to give us a call, make comments, questions. We're always open to do that. Our number here is area code 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. Call that number at any time during our broadcast today and give you an opportunity to stress your opinion about this particular vital topic. We don't necessarily have a guest tonight. We want to just use the participation of many of us there online and talk a little bit about the power of the Black press and what it really does mean for us in African-American life. Okay, so I'm going to get ready and begin to do that. But first, as always, we must praise those bridges that brought us over. And that is our ancestral profile. We have done this now. This is a very major part of our program. And so tonight I want to maybe introduce to some, and very clearly the audience that we have here on Black Reality, this is not an introduction, but a reinforcement, because I know everybody here has heard of this great ancestor, and we just want to kind of talk about him. So that was an order. That was an editorial that appeared in the Wall Street Journal that kind of initiated me to want to talk about him tonight as an ancestor. And I'm just going to quickly read the clip. It says that more than a century after his conviction, boxing great Jack Johnson, the first Black man to become the heavyweight champion of the world, was granted a posthumous pardon by President Donald Trump last week. And although historians, boxing aficionados, and politicians, including people like Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, State Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada, Democrat from Nevada, have been pushing for Johnson's case for years, it almost seems fitting that Trump did it. Johnson, like Trump, enjoyed the limelight. So we are asking tonight, who was Jack Johnson? First of all, why did he need to be pardoned? That's the first question. Well, according to history and recording, he had violated something called the Mann Act. By the time that Jack Johnson had become heavyweight champion, he had a penchant for flaunting his wealth, his power, and his masculinity. That naturally is going to result in him dating and maybe marrying outside of his race. And in this case, he married a white woman. The Mann Act was signed into law in 1910 to, number one, address prostitution, immorality, human trafficking, but it was also to prosecute unlawful premarital, extramarital, and interracial relationships, which is where Johnson comes in. Twice in 1912, Jack Johnson was arrested under the Mann Act for transporting at least two women across state lines for immoral purposes. An all-white jury convicted Johnson, but he skipped bail and he lived in exile. He finally surrendered in 1920 and spent 10 months in prison. On December the 26th, 1908, Johnson made history when he beat Canadian Tommy Burns in Sydney, Australia for the heavyweight title. All existing footage of the Burns fight stops just as he hits the canvas. Before that, Johnson had been the world colored heavyweight champion. He essentially competed in black boxing circuit and was denied a chance to fight for the heavyweight championship. Johnson lost the title in 1915 to Jess Willard. He finished boxing with a 73-13 record, including 40 knockouts. Why did they call him the Great White Hope? I mean, who was called the Great White Hope and why? As Johnson had dominated professional boxing, humiliating a string of white opponents, there became a call for a great white hope to defeat him and restore the natural order of boxing. While the name was a concept, the great white hope finally arrived in the massive form of a man named James J. Jeffries. He was a retired former heavyweight champion, famous for breaking the ribs of his opponents. Jeffries was lured out of retirement in 1910 to fight Jack Johnson, telling reporters, "I'm going into this fight for the sole purpose of proving that a white man is better than a Negro." Jeffries had said to that statement. Johnson destroyed Jeffries, however, knocking him out and through the ropes in the 15th round. Johnson said, silence this
night. Jeffries was reared out of his retirement in 1910.
I apologize for that. That was the mic was open and I had to mute that. Okay. So nevertheless, Johnson defeated Jeffries, and he did it so early as the fourth round. And after the fight, race riots broke out across the United States between jubilant African-Americans and this clearly upset whites. At least 20 people were killed during this fight. Where did Johnson come from? Johnson was born March 31st, 1878, in Galveston, Texas. Both of his parents were former slaves. He was a very frail young man. He spent only 5 years in school before quitting to work. After a series of menial jobs, he saved up enough money to buy a pair of boxing gloves for himself, and his first professional fight was in 1898. After losing the title in 1915 and going to jail in 1920, Johnson never fought again for the championship, but still made his way into the ring as a professional up until 1938, when he was 60 years of age. In 1937, Joe Louis knocked out Jimmy Braddock to become the first black heavyweight champion of the world since Jack Johnson. Joe Lewis was marketed as the anti-Johnson, and his camp even refused an offer from Jack Johnson to help train the young champion. Johnson's last appearance in the ring came in 1945 in an exhibition to raise money for war bonds. And on June 10, 1946, while traveling through Franklinton, North Carolina, the former heavyweight champion was refused service at an all-white diner. Angrily, he raced off in his car and crashed on US 1. He was taken to the nearest black hospital, which was St. Agnes in Raleigh, North Carolina, 27 miles away, where he died. He was 68. Johnson was inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame in 1954. In 1969, a play, The Great White Hope, loosely based on Johnson's relationship with his first wife, Etta Terrier Duryea, won the Tony Award for the best play and the Pulitzer Prize for drama. And we also recall the movie that appeared with James Earl Jones, as Jack Johnson also appeared around the late 1970s, the early 80s. Jack Johnson's career signifies a lot of the way America treated African Americans and their fear of the black male image. Johnson proved that. He proved that the strength and the power of the black man could overcome any obstacles, or not only in boxing, but in the way life took place and moved forward. There are many that argue that the movie King Kong was made as a symbol of the way white Americans saw strong black men displayed like Jack Johnson. However, the authors and the creators of the film denied that. But what I would ask in a critical thinking environment is to think about something for a minute. That whole period of time in the early 20th century was plagued with images of dangerous black men, starting with that horrendous film, The Birth of a Nation, you know, which came out around 1929. Now, look at the time frame of all of this. Johnson's fighting, 1920s, 1930s, and then King Kong comes out in 1933. What does King Kong do? He comes into the city. He tears up business, according to the film, finds a white woman, and plays with her. And even though the creators of the film denied vehemently that that had any symbolism to do with Jack Johnson. However, we know by putting the facts together and looking at the history that it did. And that is the basis of one of our discussion tonight about the black press, because the black press did take up that cause and very clearly displayed and indicated editorially in their papers throughout the country that this image of Jack Johnson was definitely something that was being used in the film King Kong to display the way black men should be perceived in America. Johnson's life also talks about a lot of the schism and the class struggle within black America itself. Even though they could not find the Great White Hope to feed Johnson, they went out to try to find the Negro that could displace Johnson, one that would be humble and meek and would not have that and would look different and would be much more appealing to the white audience and to the white press. And that is the role that Joe Lewis came in. Now, whether that Joe Lewis's mentality was succumbing to that, we don't know. You would have to read his biography. I'm not quite sure. But Joe Lewis was definitely and very clearly an individual that struggled heavily with a lot of areas. They depict the way he talked, and, you know, they talked about he was not educated and so forth and so on. But very nice. He married a black woman. He stayed away from white women. He looked good, and so he was successful enough to go forward into the Max Schnelling and so forth and so on. So all of you are boxing fans. You know more of the history of that. But I thought maybe that tonight we would profile the great Jack Johnson, because, again, it does embrace into our discussion as well about the black press, because it is the black press that would support Johnson in everything that he did. Also, okay, I'm going to also at this time, I want to, as I indicated last week on our program, there are a couple of areas that I'd like to talk about, and there are a couple of things that I'd like to for us to look at in terms of things that are going on, suggestions of books and activities. Last week on our Black Reality Think Tank program on Blog Talk Radio, we did a whole profile of new books that were out, looking at the whole political economic agenda, and we offered those as suggestions for people that might want to read, and not only just some of the new things, but a lot of the old books, refresh your memory. So we did do that on Blog Talk Radio on last Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m. So today I just want to mention a book that has just recently been published that obviously would make good reading for many of our readers, particularly the audience that we have here. And it is a book called Barracoon, The Story of the Last Black Cargo by Zora Neale Hurston. And obviously it's not new, but Zora Neale Hurston is an ancestor writer, but however, it's new in terms of its publishing. This is the story of an African who was from Kasula. He was from the country of Kasula in Africa, where in 1859 he was captured and illegally shipped to Alabama with more than 100 others to be forced into slavery. He became Cujo Lewis, on the American soil. That was his American name. In 1927 and 1928, when Lewis was about 86 years old, Zora Neale Hurston conducted a series of in-person interviews with him. He proved to have an astonishing memory. Hurston was a trained ethnographer. She had worked with a professor out of Columbia University by the name of Franz Boas, and she was kind of dealing in that anthropology area. She was not an anthropologist, but very clearly an ethnographer in terms of her writing. She captured, however, the rhythm and the idioms of his dialect, sort of the way Paul Laurence Dunbar did with the African captive dialect. Here's an example of his writing. It says, "We cry for home. We took away from our people. We 70 days crossed the water from the Africa soil, and now they part us from one another. Therefore, we cry." Hurston refused to clean up that dialect. A publisher had requested that they would publish the book, but they wanted her to clean up that dialect and put it in more positive English. She refused. So Barracoon never saw publication until now. It's a monumental achievement, mind-blowing and heartbreaking. It is a wise and beautiful foreword, as stated by Alice Walker. She makes the case for this book. She talks about it from its historical and anthropological importance. She says, this is, make no mistake, a harrowing read. And the book is published by the Amistad Press, and it is available for $24.99. As always, I indicate, go to your Black bookstore first and see if they have it. If not, then the obviously big bookstore owners, bookstore retailers, I'm sure do have it. But first, check your local Black bookstore as a means of doing that. Okay, my brothers and sisters, let's get in as we take a look at the Black press and talk about why it's significant and what does it really mean. Now, as I've indicated earlier, that the Black press touches on so many different areas. First of all, it's a wonderful kind of primary source for studying history. If you want to know what really was going on, for instance, with the Jack Johnson situation and, you know, that whole idea, then it would be very good to go into the archives of some of the Black newspapers, particularly papers like the New York Amsterdam News, the Chicago Defender, and some others who clearly had national representatives that they sent out to follow that. That would be an excellent way of doing that. And it gives you a chance. And even, for instance, the Nat Turner revolt, the black press had started prior to Nat Turner's revolt. So if you want to really get a the way the African-American community might have seen that, the black press is a good way of doing that. These are all archived now. A lot of them are available online. Some are. And it's a good way of being able to go in and connect history. It also is another way of looking at individuals that were not necessarily popular, but very powerful for things like the abolitionist movement, things like the civil rights movement, the fight for segregation, the fight against the lynchings. The black press covered all of that. And so tonight I'm going to talk about its tentacles and how it was able to reach out and put its hands on key things. At that time, when it first started, the big newspapers out, the papers like the New York Age, which is a Pulitzer paper, it was very clearly anti-African. It was totally in favor of slavery. It was pro-slavery in a lot of ways. A lot of the papers were. They were promoting. They were running ads in the paper about runaways and doing some very, very negative things and putting Africans in a very bad light. So, and then they were pleading those that were kind of moderate were pleading the abolitionist cause in a very negative kind of way. So it would have never changed if we would have relied upon the black newspaper. I mean, relied upon those mainline white presses, just like they do today. So that is one of the major and the most powerful tools that the black press offered. In 1827, there were a group of free African, and when I say free, I mean that they were not owned by anybody. They weren't free from slavery, but they just didn't have ownership by any person. John Hope Franklin has a wonderful phrase for that in his book, Slavery to Freedom. He calls them quasi-free, and they were. They were quasi-free. That means that they weren't owned by anybody, and they had to provide for their own selves, and they had no plantation. They had no work duties they could go on. But they did still were working and living and walking and breathing in the slaveocracy, which means that at any moment their status could change. So anyway, this group of prominent free African-American citizens from states, particularly along the eastern coast, eastern seaboard, met in New York City at the home of a man named Boston, B-O-S-T-I-N, Crummell. Boston Crummell. Boston Crummell is the father of Alexander Crummell. He is also, Boston Crummell, was the son of an African chief from Nigeria, from the region of Nigeria. At that point, it was connected into Ghana, which was actually, it was Ghana. So he was an African chief in Ghana. And so anyway, they met at Boston Cromwell's house to discuss means to sort of communicate their views on the various social, political, and economic issues that had commonly confronted the black community, and to also talk about things that they could do to resolve some of the challenges. And although African-American citizens utilized the church and social fraternal organizations as a means of collective expressions and dialogue, the usual channels of public media, particularly the newspapers, were really denied to them. So they did not have a voice in public newspapers at the time. So they did need something else that they could look at and use. So exacerbating the problem was the fact that elements of the established press routinely denigrated African Americans in print, as I've said. They lambasted us, said all kind of negative things. So they pleaded the cause of Africans, but they pleaded the cause from their perspective. The most significant outcome of that meeting at Mr. Crummell's house in the winter of 1827 was the decision to begin the publication of our own newspaper, which at that point would have been the first newspaper produced by African Americans in America. And they called it Freedom's Journal. There were two attendees at that meeting. One was named Reverend Samuel Cornish, and the other one was John B. Rushworth. And it was decided to elect them to be the paper's editors. Their job basically was to begin to think about editorially how to address the issues and to begin to format a language in order to do that.
We're told that the ideal body is about half of...
I'm sorry about that. Sometimes folks come online, I don't know their own, and they come on with their mics live, so I have to stop sometimes and mute the mic just temporarily. But anyway, we were talking about that these two individuals would definitely be chosen to look at how to frame editorially the paper and how to determine, you know, whether or not it would be used in a certain way and what would be said and what not to be said. And then obviously, you know, how it would be funded. You know, how would they pay for it? So the meeting was attended by about 11 men, according to one publication. And those men were very serious about this work, and they were looking at how to, as I said, how to display the message. Now, here's the significant part of that meeting. One of the major areas of discussion at that meeting was to talk about immigration back to Africa. There were arguments throughout America on immigrating back to Africa. And as I've discussed on a couple of other of our programs, that one of the things was there were many who did not agree with that. They wanted to immigrate back to Haiti. And then there was also the movement to immigrate to Canada. So Africa wasn't a solo process. There were many that simply just disagreed with that. So at this meeting was a man named Peter Williams Jr. Peter Williams Jr. was an African-American Episcopal preacher. And he had been ordained in the United States, and he was the first to serve in New York City. And he was an abolitionist. And he also supported free black immigration to Haiti, not Africa. He felt that the black republic that achieved independence in 1804 in the Caribbean would be the best place for Africans to go. So in the 1820s and 1830s, he strongly opposed the American Colonization Society efforts. And that was a lot to do with the fact that a lot of the American colonization was basically involving Europeans and involving whites. And it was not necessarily one in talking about liberation. A lot of them were planters, plantation owners, who were involved in the colonization society. So in 1808, he had organized a church called St. Philip's African Church in Lower Manhattan in New York. And this was the second black Episcopal church in the United States. And so in 1827, he got along with this group of guys, and he was one of the co-founders of Freedom's Journal. And when I say co-founders, even though we have heard John Rushworth and Samuel Cornish, Peter Williams put the money into it. He put the dollars up to print it, because obviously now you got to have a way to print it. That's going to be a cost, and obviously a way to distribute it. And so what Peter Williams would do was use his church to finance the backing of the printing and obviously the distribution of the newspaper, Freedom's Journal. So in actuality then, Peter Williams was one of the co-publishers. And we don't hear his name when we hear the whole history of the Freedom's Journal. Peter Williams was very politically connected. He belonged to an organization called the Phoenix Society. And the Phoenix Society was one of those many organizations that we also talked about last week when I did the ancestor profile on Cassie House. This was one of those organizations that was working with trying to find funds for Africans who had been or enslaved, providing money. They called them mutual aid societies. And this was a way not only to that, but also to fund things like the Underground Railroad, as well as to fund the immigration back to Africa movement idea, and very clearly to go on and to support, you know, whatever legislation would want to go forward. If you look at Freedom Journal's first issue, that'll kind of give you a real good idea of what the purpose of these papers were. Because a lot of times when you think of purpose, we think of news, and we think of things that are happening or something this, or somebody's going to have a meeting here. I mean, it included that, but it was a lot more deeper. And that's the point that I want to make here now. These were weapons. These were organs to fight the abolition of slavery and to find the best way for African people to survive trying to live here in this country. That is the history of the black press. So Peter Williams was an organizer, and he founded the Phoenix Society, which was this funding organizer. And he also became a part of a mixed racial group called the American Anti-Slavery Society. And he was a big part of that, and he participated in that as well. He was a very well-educated man. And again, as I said before, he used that Episcopal Church as a way of getting the message out on ways that we can fight slavery. So Freedom's Journal then begins. And this whole idea of immigration is really the driving factor behind this paper. One of the first articles in issue one of Freedom's Journal is going to deal with the discussion on Paul Cuffee. And they were talking about Paul Cuffee in that first article. It was a four-page paper. It was a four-pager. And then eventually it would expand to a larger paper as well. This, however, set off the motion for a lot of other organizations to come forward and to look at the possibilities of starting a paper. One of the first ones after Freedom's Journal started in 1828. It was called the Anti-Slavery Journal, or in other words, the African Journal. And it was published in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And so it was published there, and it also had a publication location in Boston, Massachusetts as well. Samuel Cornish decided in 1829 to change the name of Freedom Journal to the Rights of All. But however, this began the schism within the structure of the organization, and it actually began to become their decline. Because at this particular point, the fighting over whether to go to Haiti or to go to Africa or to go to Canada had heightened somewhat. There were journalists like, there's a name that we very frequently hear of. His name was Irvin Penn. He was also a writer along these lines as well. And this seems to have been where the schism was. Haiti was a lot more organized. And it was definitely had a more of a focus, whereas Africa, and mainly because of those resources and the Euro world that was involved there, and the fact that there were slave raiders still in Africa, many people argued it would be dangerous to go back to Africa at that particular point. And there were slave raiders. And we talked last week about a big insurrection that occurred where this African chief attacked a group of Africans from America in Liberia because of the fact that it was going to interfere with his trade business that he was going on to get weapons. But nevertheless, Freedom's Journal was getting to to publish these ideas, obviously opposing slavery. It talked a lot about the current issues. It talked about its proposal of the American Colonization Society. It even talked about some of the other spiritual institutions that needed to come forward. It was encouraging the AME Church with Richard Allen to also appear. He had a letter that appeared in the November issue of the Freedom Journal. And then there was a Reverend Lewis Woodson, who was also associated with the American African Methodist Episcopal Church, be involved as well. The journal did things like publish biographies of people. So that's why I said it's an excellent history book to go in. And these are obviously biographies and deaths of people that are not quite as famous, say, as known as Cornish and Salem and think people like that way. But it was used as a tool to do that. One of the writers of Freedom's Journal was David Walker, who was well known with David Walker's Appeal. He wrote that as well in that Freedom's Journal. So Freedom's Journal definitely started something that would carry forth for a very long, long time and would begin to become a tool that many others would join. So real quickly, just giving you a background of the flow and the influence that Freedom Journal had. Another independent paper that popped up in Columbus, Ohio in 1839 was a newspaper called the Palladium of Liberty. And again, the idea is to look at these papers and look at, what they are publishing and what they are writing about, and it'll give you a real clear image of how all of this progressed in terms of our history, and really giving us a history from our own perspective. And so the 19th century saw many new newspapers. Alexander Bales' Colored American came forward, Frederick Douglass's The North Star. He had another paper called The National Era, and he also did a monthly. In the 1860s, newspapers like The Elevator, The Pacific Appeal, all of these were being published in California, where they were pushing blacks and Africans who were participating in the gold rush. And see, this is a good way to look at the history of that that we may not get out of a textbook. One of the very few historians that used the black press and the black newspapers as resources was Dr. Mary Frances Berry, Mary Frances Berry, in her book Long Memory. And she did a wonderful job of going in and looking at it. And then there are other historians that have done so as well. John Hope Franklin used it too. George Washington Williams, when he wrote one of the first writings of the history of African people, used the black press in a lot of his work. And he was able to, at that point, show and talk about some of the devastating things that would happen. And what's interesting, what I found interesting in looking at the history of all this is you can kind of also see who was important and powerful and politically activated in certain cities, like, for instance, Cleveland. Cleveland, Ohio, had a very active political African-American community, because they popped up with several newspapers. There was a paper called The Alienated American that came out of Cleveland in 1852. And usually what you found is that the publishers of these papers were very strong, active people. And they were very dedicated to the black cause. And so they were willing to put their money into papers, because obviously it was not a profitable adventure in terms of business. It just wasn't that profitable. And you had to consider, first of all, the printing. How was that going to be done? And how would you distribute it? And how do you pay for things like that? And very clearly, there was no pay involved in that. In 1852, a woman by the name of Mary Ann Shad Carey created a prototype of a newspaper she called the Provincial Prototype. provincial prototype. Her name was Mary Ellen Shedd, and she was urging, she used her paper to urge African people to emigrate to Canada following the passage of the Fugitive Slave Law. And the AME Church started its first paper. It was the official organ of the AME Church. It was called the Christian Organ. And actually, it is the longest-running African-American newspaper to date. And I think the AME Church still calls that paper the Christian Organ. I'm not sure, but I think it does. And then in 1855, out in California, a man by the name of Melvin Gibbs publishes the first black paper in California called The Mirror, The Mirror of the Times. And he's reflecting on the sort of the closing, the coming of the Civil War, some of the horrendous things that would be done to Africans. And again, all of these are archived. I had a great opportunity during my years at the University of Wisconsin to work with a guy from the State Historical Society who was putting together this humongous, he had gotten a large grant from the Humanities Society to pull together all of the black newspapers in America. And the University of Wisconsin, Wisconsin Historical Society has a magnificent and powerful database of all the black newspapers throughout America. And they are available online to read, which is a wonderful, wonderful tool. And so at this particular point, you can see some of the things that they were doing. Go on there and just take a look at some of the things they were writing. Some of the clippings are not quite as clear, obviously, because they're old, but you can still read, and some have been cleaned up a little bit. They've done some technology stuff and got them cleaned up. By 1861, there were over 40 black-owned newspapers in the country. So at the beginning of the Civil War, there were 40 black-owned newspapers. Now, what you have to ask yourself, what is it that they are saying in these papers to African people? And another question that you have to ask yourself is that we have been told historically that Africans couldn't read. So if you've got 40 African newspapers in the country, who's reading them if black folks can't read? So that gives you a chance to do some investigative work right there on looking at some of these theories that we've heard over the years. They had a great audience, a large audience of African people that were reading it. And, you know, we were also told that blacks would be punished if they read and cut their tongues out and all of these things. Well, again, I repeat, 1861, 40 black-owned newspapers being read by black people in the United States. So just think about that for a minute. 1863, there was a call in Frederick Douglass's monthly that he was doing. And he was talking about appealing to black men to join the Union Army to help fight to end the Civil War. Douglass used his monthly paper to recruit soldiers. And there were many that answered the call. It was considered the best way to win the war of equality was to get into the battlefields and fight. Well, we know that that didn't really do that, but at least it was an honorable notion to look at the possibility that, you know, maybe change could be done that way. In 1864, the first black daily newspaper is published, and it was published in New Orleans. It was called the New Orleans Tribune. It was the first daily newspaper in the United States. And it was published in English and a French version. 1866, P.B.S. Pinchback became the first black governor in the United States. He also began a semi-weekly newspaper. It was called the New Orleans Louisianian. The New Orleans Louisianian, and it was started by P.B.S. Pinchback, who was the first black governor for, I think, about 6 months, 9 months in the United States. This was 1866. This is post-chattel slavery. Then in 1888, the first illustrated journal, illustrated means drawings and cartoons, and photography was was alive, but it was still a very expensive venture to focus out, because you remember a lot of the Civil War was photographed. So that photography was available, but not quite at the level yet to put it in the newspaper. But there were illustrations, the illustrated versions of that was done. So the Indianapolis Freeman, which was published by a man named Edward Elder Cooper, and he has a very interesting history. He was the publisher. As I said, most of these papers, the publishers, are very powerful men and women, and they have very interesting histories of their involvement, you know, in terms of the politics and the economics of their community. A lot of them were men and women of means. They had money. They were entrepreneurs in ways. And they chose to use their money to help their people. And I think that's one of the key things that studying the black press helps us do. The black press is it becomes a business. This is a business venture. And because of it, a lot of other businesses were able to branch out and to move forward. Anyone who has ever studied the history and has tried to understand the history of the Negro Baseball League and the whole beginning of the Negro Baseball League know that it would not have been possible if it had not been for the black press. It was the black press that supported and advertised and promoted black baseball, the Negro Leagues in America. So the black press, the black church, and other black businesses like funeral homes were very active in promoting Negro baseball. And we're going to do a program soon on history of the Negro Baseball League. There's a brother out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who played in the Negro Baseball League, is still living and still very active and talk. His name is Mr. Dennis Biddle. I'm going to make an attempt to get him on. I haven't talked with him in a while. I hope he's well. He's be well up in his 80s, 90s, but he is talking. He is active. He is involved in trying to make this history well-known to all of our young people. And then in 1892, one of the most powerful black newspapers, and I'm going to stop at the 20th century and for just a minute and just go back and just kind of look and see if there's some questions or remarks from our audience. But I definitely want to, the first hour, I wanted to spend just speaking about the history of this and providing you what information that I have about that. So in 1892, one of the powerful organs was developed called the Afro-American. And the Afro-American was founded by a minister whose name was Reverend William Alexander. He found this, it was on the East Coast, and it becomes the largest black-owned publication in America. Now you see, here we go, black church, black press, working together. And later that year, that paper was eventually purchased by John Murphy Sr., and he was also, would publish the first black medical journal, the Medical and Surgical Observer, begins this publication under a man named Miles B. Link, L-Y-N-K. And the Murphy paper, the Afro-American, the Baltimore Afro-American, powerful instrument, powerful. Speaking to at this particular point, 1892, say, for instance, it would have talked very heavily about lynchings. It would have talked about the election of Rutherford B. Hayes, who was not invaluable. It would have talked about, obviously, the emerging of people like the upcoming of the great Booker T. Washington. Garvey's not on the scene yet, so it would not have embraced him yet. But the powerful information, and sitting in Baltimore right between Washington, D.C. and Virginia, you can imagine the politics of that day and time to look at some of the things that they have talked about. And then eventually in 1905, this becomes one of the most powerful newspapers in America, and it's still powerful to this day. And it was published by a man named Robert Abbott. Robert Abbott, and it's called The Chicago Defender. And The Chicago Defender would do a lot of things, and we're going to come back and talk about them. This was 1905, and then just real quickly, the next three powerhouse papers of America, the Black Press, would be in 1907, the Pittsburgh Courier, and in 1909, the Amsterdam News. So those were the three big boys of the block. Chicago Defender, Robert Abbott, 1905 to 1907. Edward Nathaniel Harrison was the Pittsburgh Courier. And then in 1909, the Amsterdam News, which would be established by a man named James H. Anderson. And let me just say, if you were to take a look at the life of Robert Abbott, the life of Edward Nathan Harrison, and the life of James Anderson, you would be overwhelmed at their outreach and the things that they were doing and where they got their money from to start these papers. And so when we return to this, I'm going to open up our lines to see if they're, you know, our callers have some things to say. We're going to look at the work from there of the great W.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey and what they were doing in terms of black newspapers as well. You are listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. You know, we are here, as I've indicated many, many times. We're here every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. We are part of the Time for Awakening Network. It's really been a very great honor to be here and to look at some of the other stations that appear on this network as well. But we're just happy, like I said, to participate in this and every week, and you, the audience, who has been a part of it, and we appreciate you. Many of you are online now, and we just appreciate your work and what you've done for us, and hope you continue to do. On next week's program, we have a real exciting brother that's going to come on, and he is going to talk about his involvement. He is from Oakland, and I talked to him the other day, and he has been very active over the years. He was with the Black Panthers. He knew Elvis Cleaver personally, and I'm going to have him come on and talk about some of that relationship that he had with him, and there's just some other great things that he's done, so I'm really excited about that. So let me go to our line and just kind of look at a little bit about the what some of you may have or interest you may have about the Black Press. Go to my good brother who was on here first from Philadelphia. Who's always a very conscious participant in the Black Reality Think Tank. Good afternoon, my brother. How you doing?
Yes, Dr. Rogers, always a pleasure. You know, I have to have my pen, my pencil, my computer, and my tape recorder, but you give us so much information, I don't want to lose not one of these
well,
people.
Well, I appreciate it, bro. I really do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, it enriches me, and I know it enriches the listening audience, and as a result, I think you're going to be blessed, because anybody who gives so much, they deserve a lot, and you're going to get it. But Jack Johnson, as a martial artist and a boxer, has been a hero of mine for years.
Okay.
And I looked at some of the greatest fighters in my time period, because I came through an era where there was Ali, and there was a Foreman, there was a Joe Frazier, there was Ernie Shavers, there was a Jimmy Young, there was so many fighters. Before what preceded me, of course, was one of my heroes, was Sugar Ray Robinson, pound for pound, 100 years.
Oh, yeah.
But Jack Johnson is important to me for a specific reason. He was from Galveston, Texas. And he's not talked about like he should. Ken Burns had a documentary on him that
right.
gave you a lot of information. And in that information, I learned a lot about Jack Johnson, other than his fighting skills,
right.
his abilities, and that he had a patent on a wrench. And he's brilliant in that aspect. He also spoke more than one language. So when you talk about reading and African Americans at that time, he was a phenomenal person. But I'm going to tell you how the media and what you're saying and news affects what people thought of Jack Johnson in that time period.
Okay.
Are you familiar with Jack London?
Jack London?
Yes.
Yeah, I've heard that name. I'm not really familiar with the detail of what he's done, but that name is very familiar.
Right. Well, Jack London wrote a book called The Call of the Wild.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yep. I know.
Exactly. And if people ever realize what he did, they think he wrote about the frontier, and he just wrote about wildlife and what was the progressiveness of America going to be, and things of that nature. One of his focus was Jack Johnson. And he refers to Jack Johnson in the newspaper, sir, mm-hmm. as the gins, as the dirty one, okay. as the filth. And he built some of his career on that. Now, what you said was very important, right? Because what you're saying is about Jack Johnson and what he was faced with is that, yes, he was known to have taken women of ill repute across lines. But at that time period, if a black man was messing or dealing with a woman,
that's right. That's what that was about. Yeah.
That's exactly what that was. He was a prostitute. And if you read any of the transcripts or know the hearings of Jack Johnson, those women loved him. He didn't capture them and take them from one part of the country to the other. They loved him. But him as a great champion.
Okay.
And him as a great champion, we have to understand that Jack Johnson, before he fought white people, he was a great champion in the Chitlin' Circuit.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Ray Robinson. Ray Robinson had 173 fights. That's phenomenal, especially
okay.
in this time period. Half these guys don't even want to go 10 and 12 rounds.
Okay.
Okay. Right, but my point is that he comes and he beats these white guys. And in his greatness, can you imagine the pressures of Jack Johnson? Because the referees would have pistols and guns on him. And I was more worried about Jack, some of the film I saw, I was more worried about Jack Johnson than he was worried about himself.
Mm-hmm.
And can you imagine what his fight was? In the racism, and what they call the Red Summer of 1920. And he had so much heart, man, so intelligent, and he's a person who's not talked about much. But also when we're talking about journalism,
mm-hmm.
You give us so much history on the past, but I want to speak about Philadelphia's newspapers.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll start writing.
Now, what is the black paper in Philadelphia called? Is it still the old one that they was originally began there?
Okay, I'll tell you, it's a newspaper that's been around that I've been writing out off and on. It's called the Tribune, the Philadelphia Tribune. And I write out of the op-ed page, the educational page.
Okay.
And it had its own printing press at one time. But it hooks up with another newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And it has in the Tribune office today,
okay.
its main branch, a copy of its old printing press. And I think I might try to send you some information on what it looks like now.
Okay.
But what you're saying is very important because also in Philadelphia, maybe 10 or 20 years ago, we had another black newspaper. The guy who owned it was named Hugo Warren. It was called The New Observer.
Yeah, I've heard of that. I've heard of that.
We had another one, which was called The Real News, a guy by the name of Terry Johnson. A lot of people wrote out of that.
Okay.
They would give you these what in other words, if you couldn't get any information in the Philadelphia Inquirer or the Daily News, you can go to the black newspaper and know more about black people, the stuff that you wanted to know.
That's the point. Point of the show
tonight.
Right.
Now I'm gonna tell you something else.
Okay.
I'm gonna tell you that the problem with Philadelphia is that the black press, but the Tribune's still around, should be hooked up with black radio, just like black radio and black press should be hooked up with black television. You see that energy? At
right.
this day and time, Du Bois, Garvey, and Booker T. Washington, television was not it in their heyday. But we should have our own television program network.
That's right.
We should be having our own newspaper. It should be having our own black radio.
Radio station. That's exactly right.
See, in other words, no one should be able to come in the midst of that because, Dr. Rogers, the power of the press, on those levels, and listen, the enemy has it on all those levels. And it just goes to show you how what we should be doing, we're not. But we're there. We always were there. But we have not totally arrived. Because what you're saying about the press, Elijah Muhammad, he had the printing press in Chicago. You know,
right.
Like you said, Du Bois had the crisis.
Right.
You had Garvey. He had the printing press that he had, Negro World.
Right.
And so at this point, our machine. So when you see all this stuff, one time you and I talked about the toilet bowl of filth in America that Malcolm experienced.
Right.
See,
exactly.
But you step out of that, you should be able to read the real news about your people real things that is going
That's
on.
Right. And they should motivate you to get into action. That's the way you get into action.
That's right.
Cleveland, Ohio had a newspaper called the Call and Post. And the editor took the name from the whole African process of call and response. I need to be able to call you, and then you answer, you know. And and that's what the black press was attempting to do. You know, you're right. But let me just add one point about
you. One more thing. I'm gonna let you go.
Okay, but let me just add this one thing while you're on the subject, because I want you to respond to this. Is one of the powers of the Philadelphia African community. And Du Bois talked about this a little bit in his book, The Philadelphia Negro. One of the powers that Philadelphia had for some reason came out of the history and the structuring of Mother Bethel, African Methodist Episcopal Church. They had a powerful economic outreach in Philadelphia. Now, I don't know the total ramifications of it. You may know some of it. So maybe you can respond to that, because that's how these black newspapers were able to survive in those early years, getting stuff printed, is that they tapped into these black churches. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Now, I'm not too familiar with that, but I'm going to tell you something that I was going to do if I was elected to office. There is a gentleman, and he's no longer living now, and he was the president of the NAACP. Mm-hmm. His newspaper was called the Sunday Sun. He was head of the NWC president in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
He also had the Sunday Sun. Now, I wanted to, if I was elected to Congress or state rep, I ran for state representative twice, I ran for Congress,
right.
The first congressional district, that I would have a newsletter, something similar, as like a newspaper,
uh-huh.
A small journal, where every week I would make sure my constituents got the information from people like me and you and Black Talk Radio and Black Writing and all the history that and as time went on, somehow I developed a printing press. See, because sometimes today it might not come out of a church; it come out your home.
That's right.
Wait a minute. You could be an educator. You can start your own newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or you could be an entrepreneur. You could be a plumber, electrician. Your own newspaper.
That's right.
So we have to learn how to expand our mind. And like you said, Dr. Rogers, we connect it all. See, you can't be a do-it-yourself man or woman. You got to connect it with the rest of the world. Look, the Internet is out here now.
That's right.
So you need to be connected to all that, because we need to be together as a strong force, because anytime you turn around, there's always some type of racist comment, like this woman, I know you had Roseanne Barr.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You always got some stuff going on, man, where somebody's doing something, and we want to hear what we have to say about it, not where a local newspaper put a spin on it. We want to hear from what the black press is saying about black people.
That's why we got this show on today. Thank you, my brother. I appreciate it.
Right.
Okay.
Indeed.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
You know, sometimes we're not prepared for adversity.
Okay, I'm going to go over here to Brother Griffin. Brother Griffin, I see you on. See if you have something you wanted to add to this discussion on the Black Press. How are you doing this afternoon, my brother?
I'm doing fine, sir. Good. I don't really have anything to add. I'm just like the brother that just hung up. I'm just taking notes and making sure that what I've got is in line.
All right.
I love your commentary. Thank you.
Okay. I love it. Great. Thank you so much. Anytime you're ready, just chime right in. Okay.
Only other thing I say is, as a youth, I was into the Norfolk Journal and Guide and the Richmond newspaper, too. Oh, yeah. I'm right there kind of halfway between them in Yorktown, Virginia.
That's right. I loved it. And as a kid coming up in school, in middle school and high school, I used to love reading the Journal and Guide. I tell you, I loved that paper. I really did. And
I kind of yearn for that. I also like the fact that he mentioned, if given the right incentive, you can produce a newspaper out of your home now.
That's right. That's right.
And that might be something to look into.
It really would. It really would do that. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. All right. Caller 414-324, you wanted to add anything to the discussion? Okay. No. All right. Just keep listening, my brother. Thank you. Area code 267 902, Philadelphia.
Hey, good evening, Dr. Rogers. How are you?
Oh, wonderful, my brother. Good evening to you.
Yeah, this is Brother Ralph calling from Philadelphia.
Yes, sir.
And I wanted to add my two cents about the Black Press. I don't know too much about Judge Johnson, just from a few things I've read about him. But I'm going to talk about this present day Black Press.
All right,
and
please
what
do.
What I've seen. I mean, I'm glad that Brother Tim sees a lot of positive things, but what I see out of this Black Press we have today is nothing more than a parrot for the Sinclair Group. So, they're going to talk about Roseanne Barr. I don't want to hear nothing about Roseanne Barr. Me as a black man know she was trash back then and she's trash now, and they're just putting her out here to attract more trash, and it's nothing but a diversion. So, I get sick of our people getting wrapped up in the drama. I'm not much of an intellectual, but I know if I had my own black press, I wouldn't be talking about no sexual orientation. I wouldn't be talking about none of these no good politicians. I'll be trying to write and tell our people why they shouldn't vote for them. But all the black press is today, including black talk radio stations, and I'm talking about not this one, because that's why I listen to this one, but those that are on the terrestrial radio, all they are is a strong arm for the Democratic Party and Christianity.
That's true.
That's all it is. So, I'm just letting you know about our present-day black press. When I start seeing Ebony and Jet in the 70s go to pushing how many basketball sneakers Magic Johnson owns, I said, how's this information? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, so it really disgusts me when we embrace stuff like the Huffington Post and the Root, who masquerade themselves as black press, but all they are is nothing but a den full of homosexuals. Mm-hmm. So, I would love to get the information out there, but we're so bombarded by garbage. Just like when you eat physical food, bad physical food, well, you have bad physical health. We're taking all this bad, not physical food, but all this bad information, and it's making us sick, man.
Yeah.
And we cannot continue to live like this. So, that's why your program, the programs on Time for Awakening, are so important, because, like Brother Booker says all the time, it's time for a new paradigm. We need to get our minds straight.
That's
man,
right.
We are sick people.
That's
if
right.
We can admit that first, then there's hope for us. But as long as we're prideful in this mess, we're prideful over this black press, the Tribune is even a piece of garbage. Now, I wouldn't even, all they do is repeat what the Sinclair Group puts out.
and it's
really pathetic. And I get tired of it. And like I said, if you listen to the average so-called black talk radio stations around this country, all they are is a strong arm of the Democratic Party and Christianity.
That's right.
No more, no less.
That's right.
I mean, and you know, and all they're doing is to brainwash you on how terrible Trump is, but if they really were honest, they would tell you how bad the previous 44 were.
Right.
So, you know, we gotta get our heads from out of the muck and mire. But I'm glad that I was able to talk to you tonight, man.
I'm glad, too. Thank you, my brother.
We don't have no black press.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have.
No,
that.
We don't.
The only closest thing we have to the black press that gets circulation is the Final Call.
Yeah,
I mean, that's about the closest thing. And even in that, they push a cult on us.
Right.
So we just got to keep on, you know, we just got to keep on. And I appreciate your program. I just had to call in and give my two cents.
Thank you,
and
sir.
My opinion about this whole matter.
Thank you.
So I'm going to go back on home, brother, and finish listening to the rest of this program.
Great.
But I appreciate you.
Exactly. Thank you so much. I appreciate you, too. Thank you. And we want to we're gonna talk about the 20th and the 21st century black press, because very clearly, as he said, there are some serious issues that we've got to look at, and we just have to be critical. I do it out of a labor love, but I got to attack you, just like I do the black church. I love the black church. We get ready to have one of our discussions on Tuesday night on the black church. And I got some folk I want to bring on there. Bring some black preachers on there and talk about it and tell you what I think and let the audience tell you what we think. And maybe out of some of that, we can build. We can move forward. We can build. Okay, area code 60243. How you doing, my good brother, Marcus? How you doing today?
I'm doing good, Dr. Rogers. I'm doing great. Excellent.
Yeah.
You know, I would say that programs like this, I say, as far as Jack Johnson, I'm like Brother Ralph. I don't know too much about the brother, you know, so I can't really comment too much, you know. But as the black press concerned, I would say this, what we're doing here is like a continuation of the black press.
Yes,
it's
it
an
is.
Electronic yes. press, you know what I'm saying?
That's right.
So it's, you know, and I noticed you said there was a gap between 1866 and 1888. And if I am not, if when you look at that gap, it would make sense, because that was after the Civil War. And that
right.
was when they really repressed black folks.
Right.
You know, that was when the black codes and the Ku Klux Klan and the terror was
right.
taking place, and black people had to move, because they had I think during that time they had a great migration, the internal migration.
That's
a lot
right.
of blacks left the South.
That's
and
right.
went north to get away from the terror that the Confederate soldiers, you know, were putting down on black people,
mm-hmm.
because that was they removed the Union soldiers. And, you know, it created, so those Confederate, they had a free reign, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I found something out today. There was recently in a city in Mississippi called Natchez.
Oh, yeah.
It was terrible what happened in Natchez at the hand of the Union soldiers.
That's right.
Black with black folks.
Yep.
You know how they intern black people in that, what they call it, the devil's sponge bowl. You
yeah.
know, it was terrible.
Yeah.
But, you know, I see it as, you know, it may look like we're not kind of making progress, but when you really look back, you know, and you see, because you remember back in the days, you know, if a black man, you know, a white woman could just say, look, you raped me. And they would just lynch you. You would a lynch mob would form and
that's right. That's
just
right.
lynch black people. Who will
yeah.
see a lynching?
You didn't have
you know,
to do much.
That's
yeah.
how Tulsa got burnt down. That's Rosewood, you know, and it was just by a white woman saying, and even recently the brother there, Emmett Till.
Right.
See what they did to
yeah.
Emmett Till.
Yep.
But you know, we are moving. You know, it is slow. But what we have to do, we have to amplify, as one brother said, Brother Paul from England said, programs like this and the Time for Awakening radio program, we have to amplify it. You know, each right. of us should you know, tell our friends, pass it along. That's what I do. I send it to Africa. I send it to people in Africa. I say, look, listen to this. Because, you know, fantastic. We have to stir up our people and get the whole thing turning. So, you know, it may look hopeless, but looking back and see where we are coming from, you know, we slowly making progress, you know, and
that's
we just
right.
have to just
that's
keep
right.
our eye on the prize, as you know, the brother said.
Yep,
and I'll,
right.
I'll hang up and continue listening. Thank you, good brother.
Thank you so much, brother Marcus. I appreciate it. Thank you. You're right.
All right.
So you know, and you're right. There is hope. And as the brother said, you know, Philadelphia, they call you. We gotta wake up, though. You know, you can't continue doing some of the same stuff that we were doing, and very clearly. So, brother Elliot, if you're listening, I want you to know that you're on the right track with the creation of TimeForAwakening.com and for the Black Talk Radio Network.com. You're on the right track. Give us a chance to get out here and say some strong things and push forward, you know, the agendas will change. You know, that's the key. And so I want to do that. Now, I want to go back a little bit to the history. I left out something that I did want to mention earlier. There was a black newspaper that was found. It became the first newspaper directed strictly at women. And the founder was Josephine St. Pierre Ruffin. Her name was Josephine Ruffin. She founded the first newspaper written for and by women. It was called The Women's Era. The Women's Era, E-R-A. And it was actually the official paper for the National Association of Colored Women. The National Association of Colored Women. And this is a critical piece, because the National Association of Colored Women was a powerful organization. Women like Mary Church Terrell, Mary McLeod Bethune, and these women that were really fighting for change in another way, right alongside their brothers. Ida B. Wells was a part of some of these things. And so it was extremely critical that the women were addressing issues related to them and how it related to, and the things that they are going to address were sometimes a lot different. And I mean, not different in terms of the scope, but different in terms of the subject matter per se. They were looking at things like child mortality rates and why were black babies dying that were being born, and they were addressing that from a medical perspective and looking at the medical profession. They were also dealing with a lot of nutritional kinds of issues. If you go back in and you can pull this newspaper up, you will see the kind of things that they were addressing. They were addressing being raped by white men and not being able to report it. That was a major part of the women's club movement, is to address the sexual assault, you know, that they encountered. A lot of them were service workers and who had to work in homes of white, wealthy white individuals, and the men were taking advantage of them sexually. And these were married women, and they could not do anything, because if they did, they would lose their jobs and so forth. So this newspaper was critical as well. So I just wanted to raise that. It was published again in 1894. Her name was Josephine Ruffin, and the paper is called The Women's Era. And as I said, all of these papers were involved. Okay, so now we enter the 20th century. You got the three big powerhouses. And when I say powerhouse, this is what I mean. I mean that they had a little bit more resources than the regular papers, so they could put their newspapers throughout the United States, because you got to distribute them. And that's going to be a cost to be able to distribute the papers. And guess how they were doing it? Now, this is just to go on to show you how we got to work together. These same, just like Brother Marcus said, we got to use some of these blueprint from others. And we've got to tie all of this in together and make it work. They were using, as a distribution method, a group, an organization called the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. They would get these brothers, you know, with the permission of whoever, to just drop off when that train left Richmond and was going into New York and Philadelphia. As you got to the port, drop a bunch of papers off there at the corner. We got a representative that's going to pick them up and make sure that people in that area can get hold of that papers. That's a well-known tactic that these three black powerhouse newspapers, particularly Robert Abbott and the Chicago Defender. And what were they doing? They were telling African people in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, Natchez, Mississippi, as Brother Marcus said, and some of all those horrendous areas where black folks were being hung and lynched, look, come on north. There's better opportunities here. Now, whether that was correct, history has shown that that didn't necessarily mean, as one writer wrote, we left from the plantation to the ghetto. So it really did not change a lot. But however, you know, the vision at the time said that there might be better opportunities by coming north. You can get better jobs, working for the railroads and things like that might have a better chance. And so they were dropping off newspapers in the South, in those little small country areas down south, and they had representatives that would make sure that the black folks got those papers and read them and looked at the opportunities and some of the things that were available, and they began to dress them up and make them look real good so to kind of, you know, to draw the attention. So Nathan Harrison, Pittsburgh Courier, Amsterdam News, James Anderson, and the Norfolk Journal and Guide, P.B. Young, were a part of this movement of new newspapers that were encouraging to do that. And one of the things that you'll find if you go in and read these newspapers, they used to have things in there on black history. They had things in there to attract children. They were learning ideas. They had a church section. They had a women's section. They had a recipe section. They had a health section. You know, and all the papers contained many different ways to encourage literacy, helping black folks to create. A lot of black folks could read, but at the same time, a lot could. And then a lot of the poetry that was being produced now in the awakening of the Harlem Renaissance, these papers were used to publish for a lot of the writers who obviously would not have access to publishing their works in these mainland presses to do that. And so a lot of people credit the Chicago Defender, for instance, being able to set off the Great Migration. The paper had a slogan, and they used from County Cullen. It says, if we must die, take at least one with you. I love it. If you must die, take at least one with you. That was the slogan of the Chicago Defender. And that's why it would be interesting reading to look at Robert Abbott. Robert Abbott was a powerful nationalist. He was a black nationalist. And that is what he pulled forward. And then in 1919, a brother by the name of Claude Barnett founded an organization called the Associated Negro Press. Now, here's an opportunity to bring all of the black newspapers together under one banner, so that way they can work together. They can begin to share, for instance, one of the big expenses of owning a black newspaper was to be able to print it. It requires a certain kind of press. That's a lot of cases the problems today. Most black newspapers don't print their own paper. They have to send it to a white press to have it printed, because those printing machines, and those of you who may be in the printing profession, you know what that's called, a web press. And in order to print a newspaper today like you would read it, it takes a web press to do that. Black newspapers, most in many cases, can't afford that. These are multi-million-dollar machines. I think the Chicago Defender may be the only one that does have a web press that they use to print. But most black newspapers do not do that. I worked for years. During my years at graduate school, I worked for the Milwaukee Community Journal, which was the Milwaukee black newspaper. And we had to send our paper out to a white printer to print the paper, and charging them astronomical fee, as you know. And so because he could not afford a person. They had talked about one time, because Milwaukee is a unique, was a unique kind of place for a city of its size. It had three black newspapers, the Milwaukee Community Journal, the Milwaukee Courier, and the Milwaukee Times. And the idea was to bring all three of those papers together and let's buy a black press. Let's buy a printing machine. You know, pull your money together and buy a printing machine. But they didn't do it, so it's another story. That is an idea. 1923, the official paper of the Urban League, called The Opportunity. It's a journal. It was called Opportunity, a Journal of Negro Life. It began publishing in 1923. That was the Urban League paper. And it was a very powerful paper. And it also is an excellent source for those who, for instance, are doing graduate work and who may have an interest in looking at some of these ideas. Those are the kinds of things that that publication would do and indicate. But that was the Urban League. 1925, again, another paper that would be staffed entirely by women became known as the Chicago Bee. The Chicago Bee, B-E-E. And it's published, and this was kind of an offshoot group from the Chicago Defender. 1928, the Atlanta Daily World begins publication under a man named William Alexander Scott. It is the first successful black daily newspaper, though it did not become daily until 1932. The Atlanta Daily World, and that's still around. I think now it's strictly online. But it was a very powerful paper, and there's an interesting history of the owner. And then in 1929, black newspapers throughout the country began to support what was called the Double V campaign. Now, this is worthy of serious research on your own. This is very interesting. And the V campaign stood for a slogan that called Victory Abroad, Victory in America. Victory abroad and victory in America. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because we don't have a lot of time there, but I would definitely highly recommend you look at that, Google that and look that up. It's called the Double V Campaign. And it was called something from a group called the Chicago Whip. And it said that don't buy where you can't work. Don't buy where you can't work. So you got to understand that these brothers and sisters who were involved in these black newspapers were very radical because they had a voice that nobody could stop them. And that leads to why the black press has become so weak and why it had become not as effective anymore. Because what will end up happening is the white business world realized that these black newspapers were trouble. And a lot of the politicians as well, because it was also telling African people who to vote for and who not to vote for. But what was making them, in some senses, they were independent. So what started to happen, the business world started purchasing advertisement from these black newspapers. And that increased their economics. And so instead of using the economics to continued to build their powerful voice, they got hooked and addicted to that white money. And so then at that point, what that means now is that you can't talk about something if I'm putting money in your paper and supporting your paper. So if you wanted to start a campaign to talk about how alcoholism is destroying the black community, then you can't go to Miller Bruin and ask for an ad. Because they're not going to do it. Or if Miller Bruin is in your paper advertising, they're going to pull that ad out. And most of those ads that came from those kind of corporations were big full-page ads. They were putting big dollars into those newspapers. They were putting the dollars in there to control what they wrote. And that began to weaken it to the sense. In 1960, Elijah Muhammad founds the weekly newspaper called The Muhammad Speaks. which was the official paper of the Nation of Islam. And as you know, it later changed to the Final Call. This is still an independent, untouched black newspaper. No white ads in there. So you're not going to have any problems with having to pull that out. Right now, most of your white, your public, black press all have ads from major grocery store chains, particularly the breweries. The breweries really support that. I remember going to, there's an organization called the National Newspaper Publishers Association. Now, this is the umbrella organization for all the black newspapers in America. And they come together, and mainly what they do is they come together and talk about putting pressure on advertisers to advertise in the black press. And they use that as a means of doing that. Well, that's good, and I like them doing that. For instance, force Coca-Cola to take out ads, force McDonald's, you know, and they did. They forced them to start promoting in black newspapers. And so Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, Hardee's, Burger King, McDonald's, and all of that garbage stuff uses the black press to promote their stuff. And then they run coupons to see how many people are actually reading the ad, and they count the coupons and where they're coming from. They code them so they'll know which paper did what, and all kind of little commercial trickery in that way to do that. And so it makes for a strange bedfellow now, because now you've got to respond to that money because you're getting used to it. The Black Panther publishes a newspaper out of Oakland in 1967. Finally, the world begins to see and appreciate the black photographers who were a part of those black newspapers, because now photography became a part. And one of the first ones to reach the national notoriety was Mr. Sleet from Jet Magazine. Jet Magazine was also a very powerful newspaper, you know, even though it was a magazine, but it did give weekly, daily news. And then in 1963, an organization is founded called the Association of Black Journalists, and it is formed in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This organization was the precessor to the National Association of Black Journalists, the NABGA, which is a very powerful organization, but it also consists of writers from white press as well. And then in 1965, 44 of the black newspapers came together and formed the National Association of Black Journalists, which is operating out of Washington, D.C. And that's just kind of a little brief timeline of some of the activities of the black press. But I think what you have to do is read in between the lines of all of this. And then you can begin to kind of understand some stuff. Just like the black church, the black press went commercial. And through its commercialism, it then lost its power, and it became weaker. There were a lot of black newspapers were not necessarily supporting the nationalist agenda during the years of the civil rights. Why? They had a lot of white advertisers that were going to pull out those ads if they did. So they couldn't support a Malcolm. They couldn't support a Black Panther Party. They couldn't support that. It was only a few organizations that were able to do it. That's one of the reasons the Panthers started their own paper, because the black press wasn't joining in. So in the 60s, 70s, you began to really see it weakening in terms of its effect of reaching the community. Now, I grant you that there are still black newspapers that are there, but as the brother said from Philadelphia, a lot of it is now honed around Democrats and Republicans and all of that stuff, because when a politician runs for office, the first thing they do is go after a Democratic ad, you know, in a full page, and you want to get that full page ad running for about 6 or 7 weeks, which very well could be, you know, $10,000, you know, an ad, you know, so you're talking running 7 or 8, you could get $100,000 just for running a politician's ad. So, and I don't recall many full page ads when Obama ran for president. I don't recall I remember there were some large quarter-page ads and things like that. And I do look at the black press consistently. I read the Amsterdam News. I do read sometimes the Chicago Tribune, Chicago Journal guy, I mean Chicago Defender, I'm sorry. I do still read that. I like the Baltimore African American, but it has really changed now. It's just not the effective tool that it was. And so it has fallen victim to commercialism, and that's really the bottom line, and that's where the shame lies, is that it has fallen into hands of that. I have another caller. I definitely want to bring them on. We don't have too much time left, but I want to bring my caller on. This call is 336-621. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank.
Good afternoon, Doc. How are you?
Fine. Doing great. How are you doing today?
All right. Yeah, you're just feeding us all the information that we need, or knowledge, I'll say, historical knowledge.
Yeah. Thank you.
Of course, my other phone goes off as soon as I get on this call. I just need to get rid of this noise right here. Okay, we just put it in another room. So I wanted to, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. We're here.
Okay, I'm sorry. My other phone started ringing as soon as you clicked on to me. But anyway, I wanted to, you covered some of what I wanted to mention and ask. But have you discussed what are the forces that got rid of pretty much every form of black media? Because I heard you talking about the various black newspapers,
mm-hmm.
you know. But every show, every constructive black show that was on TV eliminated, erased. The last one, I think, was Tavis Smiley. He wasn't even that constructive. But once in a while, he'd have something related to black folk that was significant.
Mm-hmm.
But between the newspapers, television shows, radio shows, it's been systematic and systemic that all of our media outlets have been gotten rid of.
Right.
And have we talked about the forces behind that and why that's being done? I've talked about before the name of this this magazine. I have it right here. That remember, I was telling you about the George Curry Emerge magazine.
Oh yeah, right. Emerge. Yeah, right. I'm
yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was one of the last I think it was the last magazine that actually dealt with our issues.
Right.
And then that was shut down, and that was just, I thought it was going so well, and I just watched as, you know, when Tavis Smiley was doing good stuff on BET, how that was shut down, and I picked up an issue of Essence a couple of years ago and saw white advertisements. I never bought another one since.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. they're gone, and have we discussed why? Why is every form of black media being erased?
Right. And it's a good question, and the answer is clearly it is an attempt to silence the black radical voice, and you have to do it at the root. You have to do it wherever the possibility of it may arise. The reason the Nation of Islam Final Call is as powerful as it is has a lot to do with the fact that it is an independent black newspaper
mm-hmm.
press.
Mm-hmm.
They print their own paper, and everything that you see in there is relegated to them. So they can attack whoever they want to attack.
Mm-hmm.
The other black newspapers cannot do that. They depend too much on Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola. At one time, the cigarette companies were all up into the black press. You know, that's kind of subsided somewhat now. McDonald's, Burger King. And so as soon as you start on something, they snatch it. Immediately. And that can kill you because, first of all, most black newspapers hire black people.
Uh-huh.
And so as a result of that, you're gonna hit their labor. A lot of people are going to lose their jobs for doing that. So the catch would have been not to rely totally on that. But at the same token, you did have to raise your income source. And then with the dwindling of black businesses, remember, a lot of those black newspapers now, you got to get, they were advertising black businesses, you know, because there were plenty of them. There's no coincidence that Chicago, Pittsburgh, and Philadelphia and New York had such powerful newspapers was because they were advertising black businesses. And uh-huh. I remember the Amsterdam News when I went to New York in the 60s. The Amsterdam News used to advertise black-owned radio stations. They advertised Small's Paradise. There was a men's clothing store called A.J. Lester's that was in there. They also had some white businesses, too, like the store down in Hollywood on 125th Street called Bloomingdale. And Bloomsteins. You remember Bloomsteins?
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Bloomsteins used to advertise in the Amsterdam News. But mainly it was black businesses, though. And so Chicago, because they had strong black business communities. But then when that dwindled, the black person's got to go somewhere else to find ads. So, boom, here comes McDonald's. Here comes Coca-Cola. Here comes Pepsi. You know, and that's politics now. Because if you say something negative or attack something or talk about take one with you, if we must die, take one with you, you put that on a newspaper today to see how many white people drop your newspaper. Quick.
So I was listening to you say make those points, and that's so important. So it goes back to Pan-Africanism.
At what
point do we do what Brother Elliott is doing and begin to promote it?
That's right.
You know, I've told several people about the show, and people are just not informed. So I want to make another point is that we're really falling short. I have to look at where we're falling short. If you don't look at your shortcomings, you don't know what to improve. You don't know what areas you need to improve on.
Right.
And you can't develop strategies, you know, by which to improve. So in my experience and just, you know, spreading the word about things that are going on, people are not really paying attention.
Mm-mm. No, they're not.
You know, people are not paying attention. And I started off asking the question, which I kind of knew the answer to, because if somebody is systematically getting rid of all of your media, then they're doing that for a reason.
Right. And they are replacing it with Netflix. They're replacing it with VHS1, MTV. Look at BET now. What have you seen that garbage on BET?
Yeah.
I mean, it's sad.
Yeah.
And that at one time was a... it was okay, and wasn't all that though, but it was still good. Lisa, you could get, for instance, on Friday evening, I used to like that news program. They would do a Friday summary of the new week's news, and I can't remember that brother that used to do it, but they quickly fired him because he got too.
And that's the whole point. You know, everything that's constructive. I've seen the shows that BET made attempts to have news shows. And black news shows, and they would last for a couple of weeks, and then they'd be gone.
That's right.
You know,
that's
and that brings me to another thing. That's something we need to do more in black media. Mike Brother Ellie is doing is talk about the black news, not whatever nonsense. I heard you all mention Roseanne Barr. I don't know what's happening with that, but talk about how many black men were killed. You know, this week.
Right.
That
right.
That
that's,
are not
that's,
you know put on TV.
Now
talk about. You know, a new black business that started that you know, we all could use their products. You know, we really need to start, we should be talking about things that are actually relevant to us, real news.
Right. And that's the same thing. I said, it works hand in hand. That's the same problem with the black church, because the black church has done that. It has commercialized itself. That was a sociologist from Chicago. His name was St. Clair Drake. He wrote about a concept called the double duty dollar, and he talked about that in reference to the black church, the double duty dollar. And he said, what happened on Sunday morning? The preacher used to get up and promote the black businesses among the congregants that were in the church, and he would promote that. He would promote that, and when he promoted their business, what do you think that did for the tithing? That business that was a member of the church, he might increase his tithing a couple of dollars, you know, and that's why he called it the double duty dollar, you know. And those are the kinds of things that are gone now. Black preacher, he's not promoting your black business unless it's his. T.D. Jakes will start off his sermons telling you about his coffee cups and T-shirts and his hats that he got in the lobby on sale, you know, and he'll spend 15 minutes before he start preaching to tell you about all of the commercial stuff he got for sale out in the lobby. You know, his videotapes and his hats.
And, you know, that kind of pimping is just so obvious, and it just shocks me that our people keep falling for it. And actually now in many churches, if you ask to promote anything, your small business or something, they'll say no.
Oh, forget it. Right. Do you remember?
It's not allowed.
Do you remember
can't
the
put
fan?
Out flyers.
Do you remember the fan? They used to have the fan. You know,
the
with
fan
the,
you said.
Yeah, they had a fan in church they used to pass out. And on the fan, it was attached to a stick with a staples in it.
Right.
What was on the back of that fan?
Black funeral homes and whatnot.
What was on the back of those fans? You remember?
I think it was black funeral homes.
Black funeral homes? I mean, that's not funny.
Yeah.
But it was black funeral homes.
Have you ever thought about that? Yeah.
Sometimes
absolutely.
Restaurants.
We don't do that anymore.
No, promoting
so,
black
businesses.
You know,
part of the solution, and again, we need a black reality think tank,
yes,
you know, with real people face to face,
is
to extract ourselves psychologically from this system.
Right.
Because we're doing what they do, and what they do, and what they're doing is insane.
It is. It really is.
You know, the dependence on money. We can do things without money.
Right. Right.
We can do things with it. We don't need millions of dollars to spread the word about this show.
Right. Exactly.
You know, there's plenty of things we can do without money, but somebody said it earlier, and we all know it, you know, we lost our minds.
Right. We sure did. It's
so we got to keep on having shows on how to get our black minds back.
Right. Well, that's why, Brother Elliot, if you listen, we appreciate you, my brother, because you're on to something good here. I did open up the mics for any of our panelists. We've got about 5-6 minutes left. If anybody wants to add any closing remarks, I have a sister on from Greensboro, North Carolina, that's commenting now. But if there's anybody else, all of your mics are on live now. Anybody want to have any closing thoughts?
Hey, Doc Rogers.
Yes, sir.
Osi.
Oh, Osi. I called you before, but you didn't answer me. Okay, all right.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
I don't know what happened.
I called you.
I didn't hear you.
Yeah.
I apologize.
Okay.
But listen, In fact, I have my Jack Johnson T-shirt on.
Oh, man, great.
You know,
I love
yeah.
it.
yep. Conquering, you know.
Let me ask you, why do you think that Trump,
white supremacy,
why didn't Obama
that's what I'm mad about.
Lead
I'm
the initiative
mad about
on that.
Obama not doing that. He could have did Jack Johnson and Marcus Garvey.
Yeah.
I know he couldn't have done, you know, Sada Shakur or any other political prisoners because of the politics in his situation, but he could have easily done Jack Johnson. And in fact, Jack Johnson, they've been asking for Jack Johnson to be pardoned for some time. Other fighters have asked for it, but because of the relationship that Rocky, Sylvester Stallone, has with Trump, that's how it went off. And then some other fighters and a Jack Johnson relative was in the White House, you know, when he signed it. But when you look at Jack Johnson, and you look at Jack Johnson's history, Donald Trump would have been one of the main ones who would have killed one of us with a Jack Johnson victory, you know.
Okay.
And that was a sad thing that when Jack Johnson, you know, was victorious against the Caucasian, you know, our people suffered, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you were caught alone, or hell, they just raided a community and picked somebody up just out of honoriness and meanness, evilness that they've exercised to come into our community to do that. But also, too, your first caller, the brother from Philadelphia, put out some good points. Unforgivable Blackness, that is the documentary that was on PBS. You can go to YouTube,
okay.
Unforgivable Blackness. It's a two-part series about 3 hours long on the autobiography of Jack Johnson. Also, too, he created a wrench, an adjustable wrench.
Hmm.
And because he created it, you've heard of the monkey wrench?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's what he created. That's his invention. He has a patent on it.
Interesting.
He has a patent. If you can remember how it looks, it's an adjustable pipe wrench, you know.
Yeah,
but,
right. That's a good pipe thing to have, too.
right.
Right.
Uh-huh. But they call it a monkey wrench because he created it. You know.
Oh, man.
So,
okay.
But, yeah, you know, also, too, you know, you mentioned in Milwaukee we had three papers, and I remember when you used to work for the Community Journal.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
That's
so,
right.
So, to me, the black press or the American African press is still needed more today. In fact, if it wasn't for the Negro World, the paper that DeMarcus Garvey produced, you wouldn't have had the response in 1920 in New York that over 20,000 of our people came to New York to establish a constitutional provisional government of UNIA.
Right.
Over a month.
Yeah, the Negro. And I didn't talk enough about the Negro world today, and I'm glad you're bringing that up. Thank you.
All right, Doc.
Okay. Now, you know, Brother Griffin just, Oshie, before you go, Brother Griffin just texted me. He said that they upped the reward on Shakur from $1 million to $2 million. Is that, are you aware of that?
No, really.
Yeah.
I just pray that, and I believe that the Cuban government will protect her.
Okay.
You know, although it's now easier to get someone into Cuba, so she may be hit anytime soon. That's a possibility. I pray not.
Right.
You know, because you can more easy to get into Cuba. You can take a plane. You can Southwest flies into Havana.
Oh, okay.
You know.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would go if Liz is out there, go to Cuba. I agree. But
yeah.
You know, so I just think that what has happened and with Trump and now the cancellation of Roseanne because of things that she said, I think that, and of course Trump's obsession with undoing everything that Barack Obama has done,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Okay.
And then of course, pardoning Jack Johnson, because I think there was something in that to him that I'm pardoning this black guy, because you know that at the time that Jack Johnson was doing what he was doing, Donald Trump would have been one of the main ones
who would try to kill somebody, lynch somebody with his
racist self.
Well, Brother Oshie, it's 10 o'clock.
Doc.
Yeah, take care. Thank you so much, my brother. I thank all of you, our listening audience. We'll be back next Tuesday here on timeforawakening.com. I appreciate your participation and all of the remarks that came from my wonderful guests. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful, productive week.
Black as you, black as me.